Welcome to Nicosia Uncut. Hello, Andromahi.
Hello, Kemal.
Well, our listeners know that we always spend a lot of time discussing Cyprus and Cyprus problem, and generally it's only two of us. Exceptionally, we have guests, and tonight because we are recording it in the evening, and we have one of those exceptions. In fact, during our discussions about Cyprus problem, one of the issues we always discuss is the technical committees. And for those who are not very familiar about the technical committees, these are the committees that are being set up within the framework of the Cyprus problem. And then the members are appointed by the two leaders. And in theory, they're working on multiple issues. So tonight we are going to discuss with two of our friends who have been our guests on different podcasts on the Island Talks before. And on this note, they are actually running a project too. So Andromahi, I'll pass it to you now.
Yes, Kemal, I think I mentioned it before on this podcast. For the past 1.5 years, I have been a member of the steering committee of an EU-funded project, this project that is called Inclusive Peace Building, the Technical Committees in Cyprus. And it is led by two researchers, Fezile Osum and Nasia Hadjigeorgiou. And we are very happy to have the two researchers here today with us in order to discuss the project and their insights from the project. And I think we can inform our audience about a number of issues that have to do with the technical committee. So starting, Fezile, why do the technical committees exist? What do they do?
So the technical committees were first established in 2008. In the beginning, they were seven. There were seven technical committees. And then in 2015, we had five more. So there are in total 12 technical committees working on different thematic areas. This covers like crime and criminal matters, humanitarian assistance, gender, culture, cultural heritage. So there are diverse areas that technical committees focus on. And of course, the basic question is why they are there, why they were established in the first place. The general mandate of the technical committees say that they are working to address the day-to-day challenges faced by the Cypriots through promoting greater interaction and engagement between the two communities. So the general mandate is written down as such. But of course, each technical committee, depending on their particular area, they also have special mandates that are given to them. Most of the time when they start working newly, so when they're established, and then this mandate can be renewed or revised through time. So in general, we know that these technical committees has kind of two aims. First is to promote better dialogue and interaction between the two communities and in a way create a kind of a common working culture and also common visions and perspectives on dealing with the issues that concerns us all. And that would ultimately contribute to the peace building process and the peacemaking process. And secondly, to address the everyday challenges that we all face as people living in this island.
So part of the project is, I think, to see how efficient they are, where they succeed, where they fail. Can you please tell us a bit about the project and the duration of the project and what have you been doing so far?
Sure. So this is an EU-funded project funded under the aid program of the EU, that is Turkish Cypriot aid program given to the Turkish Cypriot community in specific. This was the first time that we had a bicommunal academic research call in this funding calls made by the EU. And we prepared our proposal as a 3-year-long project, an academic research project. So in total, it's 36 months. And we involved both empirical research, so face-to-face interviews with technical committees, members, co-chairs, or wider stakeholders, people that have been working with them, people that have been engaging with them through various projects, etc. But also we have been conducting desk research as well. And really our aim is to better investigate how these technical committees are working. Are they really useful? Are they in a position to consider and maybe ideally mainstream human rights or gender equality or environmental concerns, for example? And at the end, so within this project, we aim to have two academic articles and a policy report and multiple events with civil society organizations to better disseminate that all the information that we gathered under this project. So we are currently at the half of it, 1.5 years is completed, and we will be done by March 2026. And I must say that there are two partners in this project. One, a Greek Cypriot NGO called iClaim, that is the leading partner. And then we have the Human Rights Platform from the Turkish Cypriot community as the co-partner of this project.
So 12 technical committees, do they all have a reason to exist, Nasia?
No, they don't. Some of them do. Some of them are surprisingly efficient.
What is the ratio like of usefulness to non-usefulness?
I think it's about 50-50, which is much higher than I expected. I think for me, the biggest insight of the project, or one of the biggest insights of the project, was how much work is actually being done by the technical committees. We can mention some of the most successful projects if you want later on. But for me, that was eye-opening, how much work is being done by the committees. And it's done, I would argue, on purpose, quietly.
So do you have some social media somewhere where you actually started sharing the findings of or the activities of the project? By the way, the name of the project is In Peace. I mean, for those who missed it. And is there already a social media channel where you actually share your findings?
So we have, if you go to the iClaim website, I can give you a link and you can include it later together with the podcast. We publish newsletters every 6 months that list the activities of the technical committees during that 6 month period. And you'll see we have already published two and we're on our way to the third one. You'll see how much work is being done. But when I was talking about the work that is being done by the committees, I actually had a more long-term view. For example, some of the projects that I had in mind have been completed already, but they are literally life-changing for Cypriots, and we don't know that they were implemented in the first place. We just accept the benefits of the technical committees without knowing much about them.
So you said that a lot of work is being done and it is being done quietly. Why is that? Why does bicommunal work, cooperation, collaboration between the people of this island has to be done quietly in order to actually be done?
So let me first say that if you directly ask the technical committee members, are you doing your work quietly? You will probably hear a lot of, no, we're trying to engage with the public, we are. But then when you start digging and you start asking them about projects they have implemented, the follow-up question is, okay, you've done so much, why aren't you talking about this? The answer that we got from the interviews we did is, from our experience, the more you talk about the Cyprus problem, the less you do to address the problems it creates. So the concern of the technical committee members is that by giving too much visibility to their work, they will be attacked by nationalists on both sides, and that will destroy the good relations that they have built over the last 10, 15 years, to the detriment of their effectiveness. So when they are prioritized, when they are asked to decide between visibility and effectiveness, every time they choose effectiveness.
In order to understand better how technical committees affect the lives of the Cypriots, can you maybe, Nasia, give one or two examples of their actual work and how the work touches the lives of the Cypriots, maybe from any of the committees, or maybe two or three committees?
I can give two examples. Both happen to be examples from the Technical Committee on Economic and Commercial Matters. And then Fazila can give a couple of examples more from different technical committees. So the first example has to do with the connection of the electricity grid. For me, that was, I didn't even know that this was happening. So basically, the story begins in 1974, when the Republic of Cyprus continues giving electricity to the areas not under the effective control of the Republic for years, because basically the understanding is that unless the Cyprus Electricity Authority gives electricity to Turkish Cypriots, they will not have any electricity at all. So in the 70s, the Greek Cypriots were giving Turkish Cypriots electricity. So even after the physical division of the two communities, they are still connected electricity-wise. This eventually stops being the case. So Turkish Cypriots eventually have their own electricity sources, but the grid is nevertheless there, remaining unused. So in 2011, when we have the explosion at Mari, Greek Cypriots are left without electricity, and they ask Turkish Cypriots whether they can provide them with electricity using the common network that used to serve both communities in the 70s. The Turkish Cypriots take a chance, take a risk here, because there is a not insignificant risk that by reconnecting the electricity grids, both sides will be left without electricity. So they say yes. I want to think, I want to believe that that's partly as payback might not be the right word, maybe as paying back some gratitude for the electricity that had been provided in the 70s. So they say yes, they provide electricity to the Greek Cypriots, and all that happens through the technical committee, because the Republic of Cyprus is not recognizing the TRNC, so it cannot directly engage with it and buy electricity. So it gives money from the Republic of Cyprus gives money to an individual, a Greek Cypriot who is in the technical committee. That individual gives the money to another individual, and that individual gives the money to the TRNC, essentially provider of electricity. And electricity is provided without the two sides actually engaging with each other and risking recognition, which was the concern of the Greek Cypriots. This was the first step towards establishing a permanent electricity grid that serves both communities. And since then, the two communities have shared electricity. So this is not a one-off incident. They share electricity approximately once a year. So that was example number one. The second example has to do, so the first example I gave was essentially help that was provided from the Turkish Cypriots to the Greek Cypriots. The second example is the other way around. We have an oil spill in Karpasia, in the Karpaz region. The Turkish Cypriots don't have the materials to clean the oil spill. They ask Turkey for help. Turkey does not respond in a timely manner, and they turn to the Greek Cypriots through the Technical Committee on Economic and Technical Matters. Again, this time the Greek Cypriots provide the material. The TRNC buys the material from the Republic of Cyprus, again through the use of intermediaries. So they give money from the TRNC to the to an individual, to another individual, which eventually makes its way to the Republic of Cyprus. The oil spill is cleaned. And again, we have improvement in our lives, A, without us realizing, and B, this improvement would have been entirely impossible without cooperation between the two communities.
You know, sometimes we get in so much despair about the lack of cooperation. I remember many times on issues like, I don't know, fires, etc. So it's good to hear that at times of emergency, there has some goodwill has indeed been shown. Any other good examples, Fezile?
Yes, so you are absolutely right, because absolutely no one knows that much about these technical committees. Even people who are activists or engage with these topics in their daily lives, they don't know. And when I tell my friends that, I mean, Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots are collaborating and generating this common work culture in a way, they find it very surprising that actually they do work on a sustainable manner together for serious issues, basically, to solve them. So it's a brand new information for many people. And one of the most useful examples is, of course, the Crime and Criminal Matters Technical Committee, for instance. The committee was established in 2008, and in 2009, the Joint Contact Group was established, the JCR. So this is kind of a mechanism within this committee that allows the Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots to collaborate, basically the police forces to collaborate, to exchange information regarding criminal offenses, in some cases, extradite suspected criminals from one side to another, for example, and basically generate this sort of day-to-day information exchange. And there are two offices now, one in Pila and another one recently opened in Nicosia, at Metehan, around Metehan area. And so we see a day-to-day collaboration between the two sides. And one of the academic researches done by NASI actually revealed that this committee from 2009 till 2018 had 1,000 instances of information exchange. And not many people in the public even know that such a mechanism is there. When I speak with Cypriot people, of course, people will say, "Ah, I read in the news that there was this crime, and then the suspect went to the north, and somehow they bring him back. And I was questioning how come, and now I know it. So this is the route that would be followed when one of the suspected criminals escaped to the other side, which is a major security concern, actually. Because if we don't have this mechanism, then you create a whole heaven for criminals, basically, to use this tiny island for all sorts of crimes. I'm not saying that this is working perfectly, and there have been actually, while doing our research, we have also been identifying problems, seeing that not in all cases they do collaborate, and there are some tensions in that. But it is also correct to say that they have been very, very useful in some of the most significant cases in Cyprus. For instance, not many people know, again, I will give the example. 1.5 years ago, there was this murder in Trigoma area of a high school girl, and the suspect immediately escaped to the south. And then within 24 hours, with great collaboration in the committee and then UN's involvement and facilitation as well, he was identified and brought back, and since then he is in prison in the north. And if we wouldn't have such committee, maybe we would be very slow in terms of intervening in this, or maybe we would not be able to do so in any way. So this is absolutely, I think, a success and a must for us.
Mm-hmm. Fezile, can I ask you something? How has this committee gone over the fear of recognition, which is the thorniest of issues? Yes. I don't know, Fezile and Asia, who wants to respond to this?
I mean, we discussed it several times, so maybe I can start and Asia can add also. Yeah, this is very interesting because we are always filled with the idea of this recognition phobia, and Greek Cypriots are filled with different kind of discourse, and we Turkish Cypriots are, you know, portrayed in a way that, we always want to engage, but Greek Cypriots never recognize us, never collaborates with us, etc. So we believe in that kind of idea in our daily life. And when seeing this amount of work and done by the police forces, in both communities, it's incredible, actually.
So I have a few thoughts on how this committee was able to overcome the recognition phobia. The first one has to do with the subject matter of the committee. This is an area where cooperation is literally a life and death matter. And this is appreciated by both sides. I think the examples that we have brought forward show that when the stakes are high enough, recognition phobia goes out of the window. So recognition phobia is something that the two sides can use, because both sides have recognition phobia, it's not just the Greek Cypriots. Both sides use recognition phobia when they feel that they can get away with it. But when the stakes are high enough, they forget all about it. So this is the first, I think, part of the answer. The second part of the answer, I think, has to do with the individuals that make up the committee. And you asked before, Andromache, how many of the committees are successful. The Crime and Criminal Matters is undoubtedly one of the most successful committees, and I think that is partly because of the two co-chairs and the other members of the committee, but essentially the two co-chairs that make up the leadership of the committee. They are committed to this. They strongly believe that without cooperation, Cyprus will be a more dangerous place for everyone. And they are willing to do whatever it takes to achieve cooperation. We don't see this commitment from the co-chairs in every technical committee. We see it in many technical committees, and these are the technical committees that are working. But the point I'm trying to make is that the people that you choose to represent the communities are crucial.
On
they
this
can
note,
make or break an organization.
I just want to make a comment here that the Technical Committee on Crime, I find it counterintuitive that it is not more publicly noted that they are working together. And why do I say this? I say this because it would actually be kind of reassuring to people. Like, people literally think that everyone can go to the north, or that there is absolutely nothing in place about this. It would make sense to explain to the public that we are working on some mechanisms, and that would potentially even give boost for further cooperation. I understand all the backlash, etc., but it is an issue that, as you said, brings results. It is an issue that people can say that it makes their life safer.
So we mentioned before that the technical committees have two objectives. The first one is addressing everyday needs of Cypriots, and the other is building trust between the two communities. This is a classic example, the Technical Committee on Crime and Criminal Matters, where the two objectives are actually at odds with each other. They are conflicting with each other. On the one hand, for the Technical Committee on Crime and Criminal Matters to do its job properly, they have to do it quietly. They cannot be, like every police force in the world, they cannot be advertising to criminals how they go about sharing information. So I totally understand the members of the technical committee who say this type of work is done quietly. We don't advertise to criminals how we work. That is the effectiveness part of the technical committee. Now, the trust building part of the technical committee, you are right. It would make sense to mention to the public that this collaboration exists. But precisely because the two objectives of the technical committees conflict with each other, and precisely because, as I mentioned before, when there is a conflict between efficiency and trust building, that members of the technical committees go for efficiency, they have decided to keep things quiet.
Understood.
There is also a lot of discussion about the fact that the members of the technical committees are appointed by the political leaderships, and their members change when leaders change. And the other, of course, information, the fact is that we don't always have the participation of the civil society or other groups structurally. Yes, occasionally, sometimes members of a specific civil society groups can also be appointed. But again, these appointments are always taking place through the leaders. I'm sure it creates a lot of advantages because then they will actually have a say. But it also creates a lot of disadvantages because many things are being politicized in the case of the Crossings Technical Committee. I know that there is one. And then the members of the technical committee do not necessarily produce a good result because they are basically taking instructions from their respective leaders. Isn't it the case?
Yeah, I mean, this is particularly one of the weaknesses of the technical committees that we identified, because they very much rely on the political leaders of the two communities. And although that is not the case that every time a leader changes, the technical committee's members or co-chair should change. For instance, when Akinjit came into power in 2015, he made very minor changes, actually only a few. And the remaining human resource of these committees were left there, so they were remaining there. Akinjit didn't actually tell them to go or didn't force them to basically resign or anything like that. Yes, it is on the hands of the political leaders to appoint someone or to basically appoint a new co-chair or a member. It all depends on them. But what we have seen in the Turkish Cypriot community with Tatar's election, we have seen that technical committees have been largely kind of the members and the co-chairs have been changed by Tatar very quickly within only a few months without giving any proper justification for these changes in the positions. And while doing research in this project, we realized that even this termination of the roles and let's say appointment of the new members and co-chairs have been done in a way that were not professional and that were not respecting all the volunteer services given by these members. And what do I mean by that? For instance, the Crime and Criminal Matters Technical Committee co-chair has been there since 2008 and has been doing great work and kind of increasing the knowledge and expertise of the technical committee with all these years of experience. And suddenly when Tatar came, after a few months, he gets a letter saying that he is terminated from his role without giving any sort of justification. And we have seen the others in the other co-chair, in other committees with the co-chairs and also the members. We have seen that some of the members were not even informed that they were terminated, and some of the co-chairs. So they were literally excluded. So basically new people were appointed without telling them that they were terminated. And this kind of attitude during that transition period from Akinjit to Tatar broke so many people's hearts, actually. People who have been serving voluntarily with these technical committees. And this is one of the weaknesses of these committees, that in the hands of a leader that is not respecting the expertise, the experience and the knowledge of these committees and their co-chairs and members, we can lose a lot of expertise and we can lose a lot of experts that have been working in these committees just because of the political leadership. That is very problematic. And how the new people are appointed is also not transparent. How they were elected? Were they elected because they were together with Tatar during the election period? Are they there because they are a supporter of Tatar's party, UBP? I mean, the profiles of the people shows that Tatar intentionally picked people that would go along with his two-state solution perspective. And he immediately basically terminated all the rest that might be harmful for his new policy, let's say. So this is a big challenge, and it's also at the same time kind of unfair to the technical committees, but it is what it is at the moment. And after Tatar, we can say that in the Turkish Cypriot side, especially the the work of the technical committees have slowed down. In some committees, it almost stopped, whereas some others did continue quite well. And the others that did continue well are generally the ones that touches less to political / social issues, but more to technical issues like technical health issues. Cultural heritage has been there always since the beginning and have been one of the most visible and supported technical committees. But other issues like, for instance, gender have been almost stopped. So they are working at the moment, but not very in a very useful way, I must say, for example.
If I can add something about the, because Kemal's question was a double one, one had to do with the members of the technical committees who are appointed by the leaders, and I think Fezilet had answered that fully. But the second part of the question was about the involvement of civil society in the work of the technical committees. The project actually focused on this question specifically, and a number of the interviews we did were with civil society members, and we tried to understand to what extent does civil society know about the technical committees. And the answer was mostly it doesn't. Mostly the technical committees do their own thing and they don't talk to civil society, which is clearly a problem. But it goes back to this idea that they are worried that if they talk about what they do too much, they will become less effective in doing it. For me, an interesting exception to this was the church. I don't know whether you count the church as a civil society organization. In most countries, you would. The church is a very, very active civil society actor in the work in the work of the technical committee on cultural matters. I thought it was fascinating because one of the interviews I had was with a church representative, and I told him, you know, I'm actually surprised by how vocal you are about the work that is being done by the technical committee. And unlike anyone else, he told me, why shouldn't I be vocal? I am proud about the fact that churches are being restored in the north, and I am advertising it. And I thought this was interesting because I think one of the reasons that the Technical Committee on Cultural Heritage is so successful is precisely because it has the support of such a powerful civil society actor in the South.
Does it have the support or does it not have the obstruction?
No, it has the support.
Okay.
The church has published numerous promotional material about the work of the Cultural Heritage Technical Committee. I was also surprised by that.
I really hope we don't see this changing under the current Archbishop, who is kind of very, very vocal against anyone even going to the North. So,
you know, I think that one explanation for this strange marriage, because it is a strange marriage between the church and the bicommunal body, is the following. The technical committee, in the eyes of the Greek Cypriots, is restoring churches. How is the church going to oppose the work of the technical committee? The technical committee is literally standing on everything that the church considers holy. And it is fixing the very skeleton of the church. How can it attack it? It has, I don't know if it was a strategic decision of the Technical Committee on Cultural Heritage to focus so strongly on churches, because it could have focused on archaeological sites, for example. But it didn't. It focused on churches, and that really protected it from any and all nationalist criticism.
Actually, that is very valid, and I have to say that I have heard criticism towards the cultural committee that it is only restoring churches.
But I'm not saying I'm. Of course,
no,
I think I would share the criticism.
Yes, let's
I agree
be clear.
With the criticism.
Let's be clear. It is not only they have restored other monuments as well, but the vast majority is churches and mosques. However, obviously, everyone can see the point, and it makes sense. It makes sense when you want to bring with you major pillars in the two communities. And
I think we also need to remember that when you, for example, restore a church in the north, it's also beneficial for Turkish Cypriots. They wouldn't like to see a ruined, let's say, a building, a church in their domain. So if you look at it from this direction, I think it's also positive in both ways. And we also need to remember that each and every embassy in Cyprus has taken an initiative in supporting something. For example, the Finns have been supporting the startups. The Swedish embassy has long been supporting interfaith dialogue. You know, Germans have worked on the education and on other matters. And I think these are also contributing to the works of the technical committee in the long run. But my question is different. Some people criticize the technical committees because they normalize the division. And some people say that you're actually bringing a solution to the problems created by the division. So you, in fact, normalizing this. I don't agree with this perspective. I think in the lack of a solution, we need to do whatever we need to do to bring the two communities together. And I think very crucial to work on these matters. But still, what do you think about this argument, in your view?
I think it's a valid criticism because to a certain extent, the technical committees are normalizing the status quo. If you think that one of the ways of getting out of the status quo is to make our daily lives uncomfortable, and the more uncomfortable we are, the more likely we are to want a solution, the technical committees are doing exactly the opposite. They are addressing everyday needs. On the other hand, I don't think it's very fair to expect the average Cypriot to be uncomfortable because our politicians are finding it difficult to negotiate between themselves. Let me give you a basic example. One of the things that the Technical Committee on Crime and Criminal Matters does is to make sure that when a parent, Greek Cypriot or Turkish Cypriot, who is divorced from their partner, takes the kid and goes on the other side, so that the partner cannot see their child anymore, which is essentially kidnapping. The technical committee immediately jumps to action, and the child is now back with their parent within hours. I remember a few years ago when we had similar instances where the child might have been away from their parent for months. I don't think it's very fair to say, well, you know, in order to solve the Cyprus issue, let that be a collateral damage. It shouldn't be. And I agree with Andromache that if we don't have these collateral damages, if we do have cooperation, and if we are careful about marketing it, if I can use the term carefully, then it will have the opposite effect of maintaining the status quo. It can contribute to trust building and eventually to the solution of the Cyprus problem.
Yeah, I can add to that. Actually, what we have discussed until now is mainly focusing on how technical committees makes our lives easier or makes us feel less bothered with the conflict itself, which are all great projects and efforts that they have been doing. I think it should also continue because the human rights violations, humanitarian concerns, environmental concerns, all these issues that technical committees are working on right now are there, are increasing, and we don't know when we're going to have a peace in Cyprus, and we should definitely work on these very crucial issues. But on the other hand, we can also think how we can use these technical committees for a prospect of a settlement, for example. As I said in the beginning, the technical committees have a general mandate and then they have specific mandates. And I gave the example of gender, for instance. For instance, the gender technical committee's mandate provides that the gender committee hands down suggestions for the negotiations. And basically, the gender committee can suggest to the leaders during the negotiations how they should incorporate the gender perspective to the negotiations, how they can develop kind of gender-sensitive federal governance policies in a united Cyprus, etc. So for the gender, for instance, having this kind of a committee work very well, we can really have a contribution from a gender point of view to the negotiations, and which I believe is crucial because currently how the Cyprus problem has been handled is non-transparent at all. Very little room for civil society engagement and very little room for gender equality issues to be mainstream, basically. And this has been one of the challenges that we have as in Cyprus and in civil society. But technical committees, for instance, gender, if it works well, it is well equipped at the moment with the mandate that it has to contribute for a settlement in Cyprus. And I think it's an opportunity for us. And both for civil society and for gender experts, basically. Yes, currently the situation is not very promising because it's largely because Tatars' policies on the technical committee, basically they are under significant pressure not to engage with the civil society that much. And also there are currently no negotiations going on. But this situation hopefully will change. And in that circumstances, as civil society, I think we should be demanding from this technical committee, for instance, the gender. We should be voicing our demands to be a part of their work and to maybe generate suggestions altogether and work on it altogether, because this might be the only room that we have currently to engage with the negotiation processes once they hopefully restart. So I think we should make use of these technical committees, but in order to make use of these technical committees for a settlement, we should know them very well, and we should encourage them to use their mandate fully. And only in that way we can ensure that these technical committees actually do something for settlement and not only make us feel comfortable during the setting that we are in now.
But if I am allowed to add something here, it's a matter of the leaders as well. I mean, and I do believe, I profoundly believe that all this talk about, you know, enhancing division or that they are creating an illusion of normalcy, etc. I think it is not fair, because I think that what is missing is a political leadership that will give meaning to the work of the technical committees. I'm not saying expose them or like say everything that they are doing. I understand the sensitivities as you have presented them, but I am saying to give political meaning, to put it in a context of constant peace building, to put it in a context of an understanding that we need to change the situation on the ground for the better of both communities. And that is clearly missing. And I believe that and this talk doesn't only have to do with the technical committees. It is very often, it is also used for the crossing points as well. But rather than putting the onus on the actual initiatives that support this collaboration, let us put the onus on those political forces and leaders that opt out of their responsibility to give a meaning to all this. Nasia, do you have something to say on this?
Yes, I totally agree with you, and I want to give a practical example of this. At some point in 2015 or so, 2015, 2016, the Technical Committee on Culture, which is different to the Technical Committee on Cultural Heritage, organized a play that took place in Salamina. In fact, they organized one in 2015 and one in 2016. in 2015, President Anastasiades was still very much committed to a solution. And he personally attended the play, and that received massive attention from the Greek Cypriot media, positive attention. A year later, when President Anastasiades had very much changed his tune, he didn't attend the play, and that the play received a lot of negative attention from the Greek Cypriot media. So the point that I'm trying to make is that essentially you have the same activity organized by the same actors, and the only thing that changed from one year to the other was how it was framed by the political leadership, which goes to show that the technical committees can only do that much. And then it becomes the responsibility of the leaders to take the activities of the technical committees and do something meaningful with them.
And what a night that was in 2015, one of the best moments of the bicommunal movement on the island. You are laughing, Kemal. But
I'm just saying that at the end of the day, technical committees are just tools. You know, what matters is the dedication and commitment of the Cypriots, whether the people at the people level or at the leadership political level, to do something for the communities and for their children, for the future. And in the lack of a solution, I think the best we have at the moment is the technical committees. Of course, we can talk about the civil society's cooperation and all that. I think it's very important that we continue and to support the work of the technical committees as much as possible, because a settlement will not mean a peace deal, because peace is more than just a settlement. And I think the technical committees are doing an important work, despite the fact that they can always be criticized with what else they can do and they are not doing. But I think to wrap up, we would like to, I think, thank our friends Fezile and Nase. They're doing an amazing job by working on the technical committees and helping us to understand better. And you know, in Nicosia Ankat, pun intended, we always appreciate the work of the peacemakers, and we know that our friends have been doing this with their different hats and titles, and it's been a pleasure having them on the program. That's all for now.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.